Two new dramas premiere tonight on TV, one from the creator of the movie The Piano and the other from producers whose credits include Lost and Friday Night Lights. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Top of the Lake, a new 7-part miniseries premiering tonight on Sundance Channel, is co-created and co-directed by Jane Campion, who teamed with Holly Hunter 20 years ago on the movie The Piano. Hunter is back for this new project, playing a mysterious new-agey guru of sorts. She started a small commune for emotionally damaged women on a remote strip of land in New Zealand. That story could have been at the center of Top of the Lake, but it isn't. It's more like a running subplot, just like the story that opens the drama, the tale of a 13-year-old girl named Tui who is found walking into a frigid lake, presumably to take her own life. She's taken to the authorities, who can't get any details out of her, so they call in a visiting female detective who used to be a local. And Top of the Lake, especially after the young girl vanishes, turns out to be mostly about that detective. And that's a good thing, because the detective, Robin, is played by Elizabeth Moss, who plays Peggy on Mad Men. No matter how good you think she is on Mad Men, I suspect you'll be unprepared for her complicated performance here. And not only because she sports an effective New Zealand accent, but because her character is so rough, so raw, and so constantly conflicted. The pace of Top of the Lake is so deliberate and the atmosphere so oppressive, it's close to the moodiness of the AMC series The Killing. The beautiful but foreboding setting is a strong character here. But the strongest, in addition to the determined women played by Hunter and Moss, is Tui's father, Matt Mitchum, a local backwoods drug lord played by Peter Mullen. Matt Mitchum is like a Kiwi version of Al Swearengen from Deadwood, charismatic and deadly all at the same time. Robin gets a taste of this when she first meets Mitchum. She's looking into the death of a local real estate agent named Bob Platt and visit Mitchum's fortress-like property. He's around back with a dog that's tied to a post and a shotgun within reach. Within a minute of her arrival, he fires the gun, killing the dog and freaking out Robin.
You like dogs?
Yes.
Would you like an orphan one?
No, thanks.
I have a dilemma. It's Bob Platt's dog. I was hoping she would settle in. She's already bit my eye dog and she's riled up the others.
Why have you got Platt's dog?
He drowned, didn't you hear? She was hungry, so I took her in. No dog should go hungry. It's not right.
Going to shoot her?
If you don't want her.
Wasn't there anyone else who could have taken her? How about Platt's wife?
Platt didn't have a wife. Truth is, he was a dumb prick. Nobody liked him. Nobody liked his dog either, except me.
Mitchum frightens Robin, but he doesn't stop her. The biggest mystery in Top of the Lake, it turns out, is what drives Robin, her own demons and hidden secrets, and why she connects so strongly with the missing girl. It's less a mystery than a character study. And despite the show's title, Top of the Lake, all the rewards in this miniseries lie way beneath the surface. Another TV drama premiering tonight, A&E's Bates Motel, is primarily a character study as well. But this time, we already know the character. He's Norman Bates, the creepy killer from Psycho, with a fixation with his late mother. Bates Motel is a prequel to Psycho, showing Norman in his formative high school years. His mother is very much alive, and her name is Norma. This new look at Psycho comes from two very respected TV executive producers, Carlton Cuse from Lost, and Carrie Aaron, a writer-producer on Boston Legal, Friday Night Lights, and Parenthood. Given that pedigree, you hope Bates Motel will work. But it begins clumsily, with a creative choice that could have doomed it from the start. Even though it's a prequel to the 1960 movie, Bates Motel ignores that timeline and is set in the present. Logically, that doesn't make any sense. But dramatically, it allows the writers to surround young Norman with all sorts of confusing and conflicting stimuli, from iPods to flirtatious young co-eds. Imagine young Norman Bates let loose on one of the CW teen dramas. And that's pretty much what you've got here. Except, in the two lead actors, you've got something better. Freddie Highmore from Finding Neverland plays Norman. And Vera Farmiga, who starred opposite George Clooney in Up in the Air, is Norma. In one scene from the pilot, they're out rowing on the local lake, and the way they're talking, it could almost be a date. But they're mother and son. Oh, and they're out there in the middle of the night, about to dump a body into the water.
You're too good for me. I'm the worst mother in the world.
Mother.
Look at what we're doing, Norman. You deserve so much better. You know, when you were born, it was like God gave me a second chance. And all I ever wanted was for life to be beautiful for you, and look at it. Look at what your life has been. I mean, what good am I doing you?
Mom, you're everything. Everything to me. And I don't ever want to live in a world without you.
What finally won me over about Bates Motel was when it started showing us life from Norman's point of view, including brief glimpses of his often disturbing fantasies. Everywhere he turns, Norman seems to be surrounded by tempting women and threatening men. So for escape and release, he turns inward. It's not a happy place. But on a medium that's already given us a serial killer as protagonist in Dexter, it's a natural progression.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching, and he teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Today is Philip Roth's 80th birthday. He's widely acknowledged as America's greatest living novelist. It's an event that seems all the more momentous as Roth recently announced his retirement from writing fiction. In connection with this birthday, there's a new documentary called Philip Roth Unmasked that will be shown as part of the PBS American Master series March 29th. Our critic-at-large, John Powers, a huge Roth fan, has seen the documentary and says it got him thinking about how you celebrate a writer whose virtues aren't high-minded and pleasant.
In Chinua Achebe's novel, The Anthills of the Savannah, one of the characters says, "Poets don't give prescriptions, they give headaches." The same is true of novelists, none more so than Philip Roth. If any writer has ever enjoyed rattling people's skulls, it's this son of Newark, New Jersey, who's currently enjoying something of a victory lap in the media on the occasion of his 80th birthday. The celebration reaches its peak in a new documentary, Philip Roth Unmasked, that will screen on PBS next week as part of the American Masters series. Now, there's no doubt that Roth is a master, and not just an American one. His first book, Goodbye Columbus, won the National Book Award in 1960, and he's been racking up prizes ever since. From the beginning, Roth was nobody's idea of the artist who sits invisibly behind his work, paring his fingernails. The hilariously obscene Portnoy's Complaint made him into something of a pop icon, and his later creation of fictional alter egos have let readers spy on imaginary versions of everything from his fame and his back pain to all the hot sex he presumably was having. Even as Roth grappled with the elusive nature of the self, he also reached outward. His novels tackle topics that stir the hornet's nest: sex, Jewishness, politics, marriage, Israel, the legacy of the 1960s. Roth has always been a writer willing to butcher sacred cows and to talk about things that others think taboo. Whether riffing on masturbation or being irreverent about Anne Frank, he's ripped through illusions and bad faith, like a man stripping cobwebs out of an attic. Of course, it takes enormous confidence to say what other people aren't willing to. In Philip Roth Unmasked, he talks about his willingness to go for broke on the page.
I was very curious, as a writer, as to how far I could go. What happens if you go further it's best, certainly in the early stages of a book, to abandon self-censorship. Do whatever you want to do. Let it be. Shame isn't for writers. You have to be shameless. You can't worry about being decorous. This doesn't mean that you have to be obscene and crazy and smear your pages with feces. That's not the point. But shame won't do. I couldn't have written Sabbath's Theater if I felt shame. I couldn't have written... I feel plenty of shame in my own life, don't get me wrong. I'm just as shame-ridden as the next person is. But when I sit down to write, I'm free from shame.
As you can hear, Roth speaks lucidly and well. He's really fun to listen to. And in this documentary, he comes across as a smart, thoughtful, rather harmless man who loved his parents and devoted 60 years to his craft. This isn't really surprising. After all, it's the nature of the American Master series to be laudatory and upbeat about culture, to suggest that the person being celebrated has done work that's somehow noble and good for you. Now, this might be a plausible approach to a literary politician like John Updike. But Roth is a guy who once wrote, "For a pure sense of being tumultuously alive, you can't beat the nasty side of existence." And this idea reverberates through his work. Here's a writer who specializes in anger, sarcasm, iconoclasm, dirtiness, atheism, comedy, and sexual attitudes that smack of misogyny. While Philip Roth, unmasked, doesn't completely ignore his dark ferocity, it tiptoes around it. We learn little about his personal life, which was messy enough to prompt his ex-wife, actress Claire Bloom, to spend 150 pages of a book excoriating his manipulative narcissism. Nor do we get much insight into what's obvious from Roth's work: his ambition, his princely sense of entitlement, his use of fury as fuel, his tendency toward political sanctimony, and his way of seeing women as one big perk of fame. Watching Philip Roth unmasked, I couldn't help but compare it to his 1988 autobiography, The Facts, where Roth spends the first 157 pages presenting himself pretty much the way he does in the documentary, as a smart, hardworking, somewhat flawed Jewish guy from Newark. But Roth is too honest to leave it at that. He'd no more let us believe that he's actually this boringly simple than he'd let himself believe in the balm of an afterlife. And so he ends The Facts with an imaginary letter in which one of his alter egos, Nathan Zuckerman, scrutinizes this autobiography and rips into all the ways that Roth has smoothed out the truth, creating an official version that sounds honest enough, but actually leaves out the pulp of life in all its fury, mire, and nastiness. In Roth's novella, The Dying Animal, the narrator talks about learning to play classical music. Like all enjoyable things, he says, it has unenjoyable parts to it. The same is surely true of learning to appreciate Philip Roth himself.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. His list of suggested books by Philip Roth is on our Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Happy birthday, Philip Roth.
It's pretty powerful for me to talk about because as transformative as Ricky Vasquez was for so many people, it was even more so and more profound for me. I grew up with a father who I never thought would accept my homosexuality. You know, he is from Puerto Rico. He's born in Puerto Rico. He's Catholic. You know, cultural circumstances forced him and led him to believe that homosexuality and being gay was a sin and unacceptable to him. And so when I came out to him on Christmas Eve, he threw me out and I lived on the street in my car for a few months until we started doing the rest of the series of my so-called life. And one of the episodes that we did aired the following December, and he and I hadn't spoken for a full year. And one of the episodes that we did that aired in December was when Ricky Vasquez himself was kicked out of his home and was homeless. And my father called me after seeing that episode, and because of seeing it, said that he understood better what it was that I went through and had deep respect for what I was capable of doing and for what I was doing. And so my so-called life really saved my relationship with my father and saved my life in many ways, because I was able to go through the same circumstances that I went through just a few years prior and be able to walk through them and walk away from them and leave them on that soundstage.
You can find our next guest on most Monday nights at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles, where he is part of Comedy Bazaar, and he offers his signature riffs on his particularly interesting cross-cultural dilemmas.
My name is Tehran. It's like the capital city of Iran. You're like wondering, what were my parents thinking naming me Tehran, right? But I'm half black, half Iranian, which comes with a lot of advantages. I have a lot of fun at the airport. True. Homeland Security knows me on a first-name basis.
And somehow he managed to get through the screen, and Tehran Soparvaz is with us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, because I really love NPR, and well, I love you. Good.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad. And we love you, and we invited you to learn more about you, but also because today is a special day. It's Nowruz, or Persian New Year, so Saleh No Mubarak to
merci,
you.
Merci. Merci.
And it falls every year on the first day of spring. It's celebrated in Iran and also parts of Afghanistan, Turkey, the Caucasus, and so forth. So what are you going to do to celebrate?
Well, what people traditionally do is they get together with their families. It's a big time of family celebration. They sit around. We have a table called the hafsin, okay? That's like the Persian version of the Christmas tree. And we decorate the table with various things that begin with the letter S. There's seven things, and they have to be on this table. And here's the thing about Persian New Year's. It's not as convenient as American New Year's, which is at midnight. Persian New Year's this year was at 7:01 and 56 seconds a.m. So we all had to get up. We all had to sit around. And it's exactly at the time of the spring equinox. Mm. And that's how it's figured out. And I don't know how they knew this thousands and thousands of years ago, because I have no idea how they figure it out now.
Okay, well, but it was a good time.
It's always a good time.
It's always a good time.
We get together as a family. Other people come over and we enjoy ourselves. So in my family, it's like we blend, we mix the Iranian and the black cultures together. So it's like having, I guess, like Kwanzaa and Nowruz at the same time.
So could one of the S items be a sweet potato pie, or is that not part of the mix?
That would, see,
could,
that was
could
it.
Be hot. That could be hot. But how did you get the name Tehran? I understand that really is your first name, but your mom is the American part of the duo?
My mom is black and my father's Iranian. And here's the thing, Tehran is not an Iranian name. It's not a Persian name. No one has that name. And when I was born, everyone thinks that my dad named me Tehran, but that's not true at all. My mom named me Tehran because she thought it sounded black enough where I could be black, but it was still Iranian enough where I could always retain that part of my culture as well.
And your stage name is Soparvaz, translates, it's a stage name, that's not your real last name.
Yeah, my last name is Von Ghasri. Soparvaz, Parvaz means fly in Farsi. So I'm Tehran, so fly, because I'm so fly.
Okay. What, there's so much one wants to ask about this, but given subsequent events, I mean, is it hard to carry your name? I mean, do you ever wish for Terrence?
I've been Tehran since I was born, and I'll be very candid right now. When I was 5 years old, being mixed in America has not always been as accepted as it is now. And in such a homogenous people as Iranians, being mixed, especially with black, was very difficult growing up. When I was 5 years old, my father came to pick me up from school one day, and the kids there and one teacher made a comment that actually made me feel, I guess it would be a sense of shame, you know, that I did not look as much like my father as other kids. White kids had white fathers. I look black, and yet I had an Iranian father. And at that time, they didn't even know what Iranians were. They thought he was Mexican. So ever since that day when I was 5 years old, I decided I would never feel that sense of shame ever again, and that I would be completely proud of my ethnic background, my heritage, the hard work that my father and mother did, and the love that they had between each other, and I would never be ashamed. And from then on, I was very proud to have the name Tehran. Capital of Iran or not, it is my name.
Hmm. All right. Well, good for you. Bravo you. And you've also turned that into a job.
As a little kid, my dad would always be like, I would do things and my dad would be like, you need to stop doing them. You can't do this stuff. And then I would be like, no, Dad, I'm me, and this is what I do. And he was like, when you grow up, nobody's going to pay you to be you. And now they pay me to be me.
Exactly.
That is exactly what I do.
And tell your stories. And one of the things that you talk about a lot is the kind of the being between the two worlds. We have a fun clip of you talking about dating in one of those worlds or trying to kind of learn the ropes. And here it is.
You want to get a Middle Eastern girl? That's fine. First, you go to medical school for about 3 years. Real easy. It's real easy. Then you email her dad. Actually, it's better if you have your dad email her dad. Your resume. And then your friends become friends with her friends. And after 6 to 10 years, boom, you got her!
Boom.
It's an easy process.
I'm a little frightened to ask if you do a black version of that.
Oh, I do.
Story.
I do.
I'm not sure I want to hear that. But
I like to cross. I really talk about the conflicts of the two cultures. And you know, it's become very hip to be Persian nowadays. It's become very hip with shows like Shahs of Sunset and other programming. Persians are in.
You've been a guest on Shahs of Sunset.
I played myself again, and I was on Shahs of Sunset, and those people are crazy. And that's the thing. A lot of people criticize that show. It's on Bravo, people. It's not on the Discovery Channel. It's not about Iranians as a culture. It's about those particular Iranians, and they're all good people and good friends.
I understand that you're working with Ryan Seacrest on a show based on your podcast, Imperfect Gentlemen.
Have a show, imperfectgentlemen.com, and Ryan Seacrest has optioned the show for a reality show, and we're in talks about having a talk show, and that's very cool.
So you do get paid to be you.
I really do. I really do. And our podcast is very interesting, and we do talk about relationships and the modern day gentleman, because that seems to be like a dying breed. Instead of shopping at Armani, most of us shop at H&M. We talk about balling on a budget and living life in a metropolitan city, and it's actually very interesting. It's nothing like your show.
What? I think my show is very entertaining.
I love your show. That's what I'm
saying.
Thank
you.
Your show is actually entertaining and educational.
Well, thank you.
I have written some reports based on your show.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for visiting us briefly at this busy time of year. Thank you for sharing some of your family time with us. Before we let you go, I did want to just kind of loop back to where we started. We are living in a time when there is more acceptance of people from different backgrounds, people who are biracial. Obviously, you know, our president is biracial, but it isn't always easy to be from a certain background. I just wondered if you had any little last words of wisdom for people who might have felt the way you felt when you were a little boy before you came into your own place of saying, you know what, I'm not going to apologize for who I am. I'm going to be happy.
Wow. When you have to check a box that says your race and you only get certain options, and by checking one box or the other, you deny either your father or mother. And that's the thing. I refuse to be boxed in. And I hope that all the biracial children out there, and this has become a thing, in 50 years, there will not be black, white, yellow, brown. We will all be beige, okay? Everyone's mixing. Whether we want to or not, that's what America is about. It's about the melting pot. Some way along that line, it became a mosaic, but we're getting back to the melting pot. And my last words to any kid out there that has ever felt the way I felt or grew up the way I grew up is, remember to be proud of yourself. Proud, being proud and having pride are two different things. Being proud of your family, being proud of your parents, especially your parents putting in all that hard work, and being proud of who you are, because who you are and where you're from is going to lead to where you're going to end up.
Well, thank you so much once again. Happy New Year once again.
Well, Noruz Shama Mubarak. Have a victorious New Year.
We know you will be doing that. That was Tehran Van Ghassri. You can find him most Monday nights at the Laugh Factory in Los Angeles. You can also download his podcast, Imperfect Gentlemen. You can find that on iTunes. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
Up next, Got a Good Job? I Cost Thousands of Dollars Each Year. That's the caption of one ad in a controversial campaign aimed at curbing teen pregnancy in New York City. But are the ads just edgy enough to make a difference, or just trafficking in shame? We'll step into the beauty shop to hear what our panel of women thinkers has to say about that. That's in just a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.